Thanks for coming along tonight, where Simon Benson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce him briefly. He's well known to you here from his work in the Australian and elsewhere, but I'll introduce him briefly. The political editor and former national affairs editor of the Australian. Prior to that, he was the national political editor for the Daily Telegraph in Sydney. He's reported on state and federal politics for 18 years, and he's the author of the 2010 best-selling political book, Betrayal, The Underbelly of Australian Labor, which was a very important book when it was published and remains so. And today, on the occasion of the launch of his second book, Plagued, Australia's 2 years of hell, the inside story, which Simon wrote with the assistance of Jeff Chambers. So Simon's here tonight, and we've called tonight's topic Plagued. No, we call tonight's topic The Story of COVID-19 and the Morrison Government. But the book goes beyond that. So welcome, Simon.
Thank you, Jared and Anne, for having me. I tend to drone on a bit. As John probably knows, John Green here, my publisher, who's with us tonight. So I've restricted myself to a written presentation to keep within your time limits. It was 12 years ago when I was last invited by Jared and the Sydney Institute to talk about our first book, Betrayal, which was John's first gamble on non-fiction, I believe. That was a story of the Labor Party about the betrayal of New South Wales Premier Maurice Yemmer at the hands of Kevin Rudd over electricity privatisation. And we all know how that story ended. But it's a privilege to be asked back again to talk about our second venture. People who haven't read it, friends of mine, have asked, what's the book about? And I say, well, it's a blend of genres, if you like. I think it's part political thriller, part dystopian horror story. And I think that really does sum up the period between February 2020 and now, because obviously it's still ongoing. It charts the actions of a government faced with a global contagion and a diabolical political challenge which ultimately led to its demise. The Morrison government might believe that it saved the country, or at least the country's economy and the lives of many Australians, but it couldn't save itself. The genesis of the book was spawned from the foundational moments of the crisis. My good friend Brian Loughnane, who I'm sure is known to many of you, first put the idea in my head, excuse me, in February 2020 over dinner at the Ottoman restaurant in Canberra, a Canberra institution that is now closed, partly due to COVID. I remember him saying words to me to the effect, this coronavirus thing is going to be big. Someone has to write a book about it. I hope people are keeping diaries. And it turns out some of them were. They were only too happy to share them. Now, Paul Kelly, also known to you, the Australian's editor at large, and I think the leading figure of political journalism in this country for the past few decades, and someone I was honoured to have launch our book 2 weeks ago, he described the starting point for political journalism as setting out in a fog of uncertainty. And this was certainly true of the endeavour that both Jeff Chambers and I undertook 2.5 years ago. Like everybody else, we didn't know where events would lead, what catastrophes awaited the nation, nor when or how it would all end. Our undertaking was to provide an insight into the federal government's approach to managing the COVID-19 crisis and its response to the strategic challenges that China was presenting all through this period. So what we tried to convey in the book was a sense of the magnitude of what the government believed it was facing throughout the 2 years of the pandemic on multiple levels. It was a triumvirate of issues, if you like. There was the health crisis, the economic crisis it hastened, and the strategic challenges, namely the challenge for the Western world in how to deal with an increasingly aggressive China, which, as we know, became increasingly heightened during the pandemic and even more so now as we've witnessed over Taiwan. But there still seems to be, I think, a national amnesia about what actually happened in those early days of 2020. I think we've, in a way, collectively forgotten what life was like back then, and probably for good reason. We just know instinctively that we never want to go back there. But I think on top of that, it's safe to assume that people certainly don't have a full appreciation for what was going on inside the machinery of government at the time. And this is what we wanted to interrogate as journalists. The decisions that were made, that had to be made, how they were made, why they were made, and often with unprecedented immediacy. And all this in the context of processes that would otherwise have been required in making some of these decisions not being available to the government because of the sheer pace of how things were unfolding. Our aim was to provide a first draft of history based on factual accounts of the time and recorded while those things were still fresh in the minds of those who were making those decisions. Some of those decisions are now considered controversial. At the time, they were less so. But what became clear through all our interviews was that the government wasn't only grappling with how to deal with what was happening on a daily basis and often on an hourly basis, but what it feared might happen. In many respects, it was shooting in the dark with the best available advice it had. So many of the decisions were made to prevent what they believed would be a worst case scenario, which at one stage, according to their modelling, predicted up to 150,000 deaths. This would have eclipsed the death toll of the Spanish flu for Australia. Fortunately, that never came to pass, largely due to the collective national response. On the construction of the book itself, our original publishing date, and John, you may correct me if I'm wrong, but it was tentatively planned for 2021, well before the election. And at that stage, we believed that this thing would only run the course of 12 months. I mean, Treasury were telling everybody that the economy would bounce back in 3 months. So we sort of thought that over the course of 2020, we'd be able to put it together and we'd be out in 2021 and we'd have captured a year of hell. Not 2.5 years of hell. And then Delta came, and then Omicron came, and it just kept getting pushed out further and further. And after much deliberation with John and the team at Pantera, who I must say were very patient, we came to the conclusion that it would have been an incomplete story if we didn't include a final verdict on the crisis, the result of the election, and the final judgment on the Morrison government. So in that sense, we began at the end with a prologue on the March 2022 election result. But the first chapter, we set the scene for a start with a starting point of November 1918. It was back then that the government, led by Acting Prime Minister William Watt, and we were just having a discussion about it a minute ago with Gerard, and there you had a joke.
Yes.
Yes. Many of you may not have heard of him. He convened a summit of state and Commonwealth leaders in November 1918 with the sole British health official to organise a unified response by the Federation to the Spanish flu. And there are rich parallels with the way Australia responded to the great influenza and the pressures this put on the Federation to how it managed COVID-19. It's almost unbelievable to think back now and recall only 24 months ago the criminalisation of activities we had previously taken for granted, such as my trip today, driving from Canberra to Sydney without the military or police stationed at the border. But one of my favourite anecdotes from the research we conducted and some extensive research we did through the National Archives, all online because obviously we weren't allowed to go in there, one of my favourite anecdotes was drawn from a telegram in 1919, an exchange between William Watt and the Queensland state government, which was hell-bent on shutting off the state to anybody. Sort of rings familiar. It is often said there was no rule book for COVID, but there was almost certainly a guidebook, and much of the same measures used to slow the spread of COVID were employed a century earlier. And I'd like to quote you a passage from the book relating to this telegram exchange, which I think is quite illuminating. With Queensland's Premier T.J. Ryan also away in London, as Billy Hughes was at the time, hence why William Watt was acting, and T.J. Ryan was only later struck down with influenza himself, Watt sent a blunt telegram on the 30th of January to the acting Labor Premier, Teddy Theodore, demanding a reply as to why the state had not yet signed up to the November Agreement of 1918 to harmonise quarantine and border control measures among the Federation. Watt writes, re-quarantine agreement arrived at by Conference of Commonwealth and State Authorities November 27th have not yet received formal acceptance by your government. As emergency may arise any day, please give your attention, otherwise proclamation and operation of agreement will be difficult if not impossible. Watt and the Queensland Government didn't have to wait long for that emergency to arise. It came when several troop ships sailed into Queensland waters. 2 days later, John Hunter, a minister without portfolio in the Ryan Government, who also appeared to be acting on Ryan's behalf, who by that stage was unwell, sent an urgent telegram back to Watt threatening to stop the troop vessels in Brisbane's port. Hunter writes, there seems to be grounds for supposing that 1,300 soldiers are about to be returned to Queensland. Extremely difficult to prevent them breaking quarantine if landed and detained. I strongly recommend quarantining them in ship that brings them into Brisbane waters. On the 3rd of February, Watt shot back a response demanding that Queensland stick to its agreement and allow the soldiers off the boat at a recently constructed quarantine station on the mouth of the Brisbane River. Watt writes, quarantining soldiers at Leighton is necessary if effect is to be given to agreements between the states and the Commonwealth. Similar numbers of soldiers have been quarantined frequently on other quarantine stations in Australia during the past 3 months without incident. See no reason for trouble at Leighton. Watt refrained, however, from sending the full contents of advice he received from the Naval Secretary, George Lionel McCandy. McCandy was outraged. He asked Watt to send Hunter a far more colourful telegram. McCandy writes to Watt, referring to your telegram 2nd of February regarding disembarkation of troops and handling of troops destined for Queensland. Unless the government is prepared to resort to the most extreme measures, which may and probably will result in firearms being used and men shot, it is thought that the men will not submit to being retained on board ship in more than one state in quarantine. Hunter eventually relented and let them off the boat, only to find three days later, half a dozen of them did run amok through the streets of Brisbane and were arrested. So what you see, I think the point I'm making here is history repeating itself. There's echoes of the past which fell on deaf ears, if you like, in quite a dramatic fashion, with the Commonwealth and the states in bitter conflict over control of the borders and the draconian measures that were being imposed on civil society, mainly by the states. Fast forward 102 years. Three things drove the Morrison government's initial response: history, politics and fear. The then Chief Medical Officer, Brendan Murphy, had been in Italy on holiday at the time in early January 2020 when he first learned of what he called this strange little virus coming out of China. He hadn't been overly concerned about it at the time, but that quickly changed when he got wind of Chinese officials withholding data. By January 23, he was ordering full scale-up of Australia's emergency response apparatus. And I think it's fair to say, and it comes out in the book, that Murphy was singularly pivotal in getting the government to kick into gear very quickly and early. It was on his recommendation on February the 1st that Australia closed the border to the whole of mainland China. Health Minister Greg Hunt didn't need much convincing, and Morrison trusted him, so in turn Morrison didn't need too much prompting either. But there was a deeper political imperative underlying all this, which is revealed in a conversation Hunt had with Morrison in January 2020. At the time, we remember, Morrison was in all sorts of bother over his perceived handling of the bushfire crisis. In retrospect, this should have been a harbinger for what was to eventually play out during the pandemic, that the federal government was getting blamed for what was essentially state responsibility. Nevertheless, and it's some way ironic, that the fear of being caught behind again on a crisis drove the Morrison government to act early and throw everything it could at the pandemic. To that end, I'll just quote another short extract from the book, and this relates to a conversation that Hunt had with Morrison on January 20, when it was not even on the public's radar. Hunt says to Morrison, "The medical advice we're getting on this is really quite serious. Every fibre of my being says we're going to have to follow that advice." The word pandemic was firmly lodged in Hunt's mind long before COVID entered the lexicon. For one thing, his wife Paula Lindsay, who once worked as an infection control nurse in operating theatres, kept on a bedside table at home a copy of The Coming Plague, a 1994 book by award-winning health journalist Laurie Garrett. When Hunt was made Health Minister in January 2017, Paula quipped, "You better make sure we're prepared." Her message was powerfully reinforced when Australia's pandemic planning was one of the first items covered in Hunt's 3 days of incoming departmental briefs. A stark reminder of what epidemiologists believed was an inescapable reality. "One day this will happen," an official told Hunt 3 years before it did. "We don't know how big or small, but it will happen." Events moved pretty quickly during that period, those final few days of January, the last week at least. By Wednesday, 22nd of January, alarm bells were ringing in the Prime Minister's office, which was still dealing with the media storm over the bushfires. Murphy had already listed a human coronavirus with pandemic potential, as it was still then without a name, to the biosecurity determination list. Hunt, who was in Melbourne, had received some troubling data projections from top departmental staffers, and recognising their sensitivity, called the PM straight away. It was only the day before they had agreed in a private conversation that they could never again get caught behind politically during a crisis like they had with the bushfires. Above all, they would follow the medical advice. "I want to do this thing through consensus decision making," Morrison told Hunt. "I want to use all the instruments of state, Cabinet, the National Security Committee of Cabinet, and the ERC, the Expenditure Review Committee." What Hunt told Morrison was that early epidemiological modelling was predicting not only a possible pandemic, but one of potentially catastrophic proportions. Hunt said to Morrison, "We do not know how big this thing will be." Now, all of this was happening behind the scenes before it really became any issue of public concern. I don't think by that stage it hadn't even been articulated in a press conference by the Prime Minister. So I think the book, especially in the early chapters, gives a sense of just how rapidly things were moving before it did become an issue of public concern. And of course, only a week later, Australia closed the border to China, and we all know what happened from there. But in terms of history, the issues that had almost fractured the Federation in 1919 during the Spanish flu were equally relevant to the contemporary setting. And we deal with this in the second chapter of the book. Hunt reveals that on March the 13th, the day of what became the final COAG meeting in Sydney, he'd taken a call from Julian Raitt, who was the head of the Australian Medical Association, who had also happened to have once written a thesis on the near collapse of the Federation during the last pandemic. Raitt told Hunt that there was a stark lesson to be drawn from this, and that if the same mistakes were repeated, then it could be a far greater catastrophe. The underlying message was that politicians shouldn't pretend to be health experts. Hunt rang Morrison, told him of the conversation, only several hours before Morrison sprung the idea of a national cabinet on all the premiers and chief ministers. And it needs to be remembered that in this meeting, Morrison's idea was met with much enthusiasm by the provincial leaders. They wanted this thing. They probably wanted it more than him. It's worth noting too that despite his criticism at the time, Anthony Albanese has elected to maintain this structure. The point I'm making here is that with this, it was this structure that put the health experts and the medical experts at the apex of government policy making, and it underwrote the government's philosophy on how things would be managed. It was also the source of much public antagonism the longer the restrictions were put in place. It was the National Cabinet that many of Morrison's colleagues believed became a political albatross around the neck of the Commonwealth, elevating the premiers to a national status that they had not before enjoyed. And with three firebrand Labor premiers, politics was eventually going to come into it. A similar approach was taken by the government with the economic crisis that the health crisis hastened. Treasury boss Stephen Kennedy emerged as the economic equivalent of Murphy as a CMO, shaping the stimulus measures that would be needed to protect the economy and inevitably lead to an intergenerational debt burden. As an economist, Kennedy was a trained nurse, but he'd also written a thesis on the economics of pandemics. I should point out at this stage the context of the book and the style of the book is that we didn't seek to make any judgments about whether these decisions were right or wrong. We simply sought to examine and bring to light how these decisions were made, why these decisions were being made, and the level of anxiety that existed even within the corridors of power. The public is well capable of making its own judgments about these decisions, and ultimately did. So in putting the book together, we attempted to capture the freshness of what those in power were thinking at the time, with all that they were faced with, as opposed to an account based purely on critical reflection and the revisionism that can sometimes come with people's recalled accounts of things. And I think the picture to emerge from the book would give readers an appreciation of the pace and scale of what was happening within government during those early days of COVID, and indeed beyond. I mean, in hindsight, it's easy to make an assessment that mistakes were made, but there were triumphs as well, which has proven as with the health and economic outcomes that ensured Australia's success was the envy of many other countries. And naturally, there will be arguments over the deprivation of civil liberties to achieve those outcomes. Again, the same debate was had a century earlier, and this was an underlying thread of Plague's narrative. The other great issue that the government was dealing with at the time, and the Albanese government is still grappling with, indeed the world is dealing with and will continue to into the future, was the deteriorating global and regional strategic situation. And as I mentioned earlier, from the outset we identified three distinct themes the last 2 years: the health crisis, the economic crisis, and China. Morrison admits in the book that while he was obviously deeply worried about the pandemic, the thing that kept him awake at night was China. Closing the borders was a decision without precedent, and Morrison was aware of the ramifications. Pushing back against the WHO and the calls for an inquiry into the origins of the virus also had serious ramifications, and as we know, prompted an aggressive round of trade sanctions. But it would be wrong to believe that this was the cause. As the book reveals, from the outset of the pandemic, and long before that happened, Morrison was being advised that China may use the pandemic as cover for ratcheting up some of its more coercive activities. And the tension had been building for a long time prior to that, particularly over decisions such as the banning of Huawei from the 5G network. In the book, we also reveal how European leaders, in their conversations with Morrison, had all been happy for Australia to front-run the inquiry while they dealt with their own problems. China's reaction to Australia served to only enliven Europe to the new reality of a China seeking to more aggressively assert its power. Morrison's view, which comes through clearly in the book, was that someone had to call out the behaviour more broadly, whether it was cyber activity, foreign interference, economic coercion, or China's military activities in the South China Sea. And of course, its obfuscation over the source of the virus, which was the cause of the greatest global schism in more than 100 years and cost millions of lives. His view was simply, if Australia didn't, then who? And considering that Australia was the primary victim of some of the activities, particularly on the economic front, then he felt Australia had a sovereign responsibility to call it out. In the latter chapters of the book, we reveal what went on inside a G7 meeting in 2021. Morrison had printed out copies of the list of 14 grievances that China had issued against Australia and handed them out to all the world leaders sitting at the table, including US President Joe Biden. After handing it out, he asked them all, which one of these would you accept? Apparently they all stood there in stunned silence, or sat there in stunned silence. What we contend in the book that this was a demonstrative appeal from Morrison to Europe to start taking China's behaviour seriously, as it would inevitably become a strategic issue for them as well. Although, as we reveal in the book, he had been using his discussions with European leaders throughout the first year of COVID to keep pressing this issue. It was at that meeting, the G7 meeting, that the AUKUS deal was formally struck between Morrison, Biden and UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson. The working title for AUKUS, which we revealed in the book, was dubbed by Morrison and Johnson as Project Freedom. Morrison clearly saw an opportunity early on in the pandemic to use the new relationships that he'd built with European leaders. He already had strong ties to the UK with Johnson and the US through Mike Pompeo and Mike Pence, in assembling a middle power bloc that would reassert the need for an invigorated Western values and rules-based model in response to the shifting geopolitical and geostrategic power competition. But while he'd been early on calling out China, he'd also been a strong voice in early warnings about Russia. In one of what were a series of sometimes colourful conversations with Donald Trump, which we detail in the book, he warned the White House about its approach to Vladimir Putin. This was almost a year before Russia invaded Ukraine. And again, I'll quote a passage from the book. Since the 2019 G7 meeting, Morrison had been quietly behind the scenes putting the case to the Americans that there was nothing remotely liberal or democratic about Russia. Trump had been saying publicly that it was common sense for Russia to rejoin the group after it was kicked out following its annexation of the Ukraine's Crimea in 2014. Morrison, on a 17th of July call with Trump in 2021, his last conversation with him, he directly questioned the US president's desire to have Putin return to the forum. "I think you're a bit more optimistic than we are," Morrison told Trump during that last official conversation. His strong reservations about Putin being admitted back into a forum founded on the principles of international rules-based order, which Australia had for 2 years running been invited to attend, were later vindicated in February 2022 when Russia invaded Ukraine. That was when Morrison coined the phrase "the arc of autocracy" to describe this new paradigm. Throughout the book, for those who get to read it, I think you'll get a sense that Morrison appeared to be a leader in a hurry, and he was an obsessive micromanager. And this approach had consequences, some demonstrably positive throughout the pandemic, but at other times politically problematic. And the difficulty in writing a book in the way we did was that we were constantly chasing the final chapter. As things changed and new crises emerged, both internationally and domestically, so did the narrative. Obvious examples were the Ukraine and the Lismore floods. Like the pandemic, these were events that were unforeseen, but then again, they were ones that weren't entirely unpredictable. As journalists, we had a front row seat to history. The plague was an attempt to allow Australians to look behind the curtains as to how the government really operates in a time of crisis. We held firm to the view that we wanted to produce an account of the crisis and the federal government's management of it that captured what was happening as it was happening and why the decisions were made at the time. I think in many respects it's both reassuring and unnerving at the same time. A final observation I'd make is that in an age of instant and immediate journalism, the opportunity to observe and gain insights that may otherwise not be available in daily news reporting or the minute-by-minute blogs, I hope shows the enduring value of journalism in a book. And on that, I hope you all get to read it. Thank you.
So many thanks to Simon Benson. As I said, there are copies of Plagued, Australia's 2 Years of Hell, The Inside Story, and I'm sure the author will be happy to sign them after, and also for our people watching on Zoom and other places later on, there'll be copies available at the Sydney Institute. So now we go to questions and discussion. Let us lead off. You mentioned, just come back up now, you mentioned that Morrison was a micromanager. Mm. Now, to what extent how far did that go? Because as you know, the initial issue with China was over Huawei, okay? But then there was the question of closing the border, and then there was the issue of calling for the inquiry. Mm. Now, Maurice Payne announced that on Insiders one morning. Was that a cabinet decision? Was that her decision? Do we know much about where that decision came from?
There were discussions in NSC about that.
NSC, National
Security Committee. General discussions about what their approach to China should be.
Can you just talk to the end of the room?
Of course. Sorry, Chair. I'd have to go back and find the references in the book, but from memory there were discussions at an NSC level about how Australia should position itself in terms of responding to China.
Okay, now there's a question here.
Simon, as it was going through, I think Aaron Patrick addressed us at one point. We discussed the problem that you pointed out, that he was getting blamed, or the federal government was getting blamed for the state's responsibilities. Mm. To what extent was having that national cabinet a real problem for the Morrison government in that? I know that, you know, getting together and making the decision together was good, but the premiers got publicity like they'd never had publicity before. Mm. Yet, again, it all came back to the federal government for being the one that was responsible. And to what extent did some of the journalists change the atmosphere in the way they reported it? I mean, to what extent did that cause Morrison's problems?
Well, I think that Morrison's problems became apparent when the states, say particularly Queensland, didn't do what they said they were going to do, particularly around borders. And then it quickly became apparent that the Commonwealth had very limited powers. So the premiers were acting within the authority that they had, and they were very extensive powers that they had. I think people were looking to Morrison to solve the problems using tools that weren't available to him, and that caused an immense political problem for him. There were people inside his cabinet that were urging him to be more aggressive with the states, but his view was that it wouldn't achieve anything. He took a view early on that people weren't interested in politics, and I think that was a right decision for most of the first part of the pandemic, but then of course politics did come into it. But I think it was that it exposed the Commonwealth's inability to really rein in the state. So his only way was to have consensus and to tread lightly with them to some extent to try and get them to do what they promised at a uniform level. And then when that started to unravel, which it did, I think we all recall what happened at the Queensland borders, there wasn't a lot that Morrison could do, and I don't think people understood. I think there was a view that people wanted Morrison to act and do something, not having an understanding of the fact that there wasn't a lot he could do.
There's a question out the back before I go down there. Just tell us a bit how you wrote the book. I mean, it's a fascinating book because it's an ongoing sort of day-to-day account. So how did you go about writing? Did you write it as it was going, or did you collect your material and write it later on? How did it work out?
It was a constant process. It was a process of writing and rewriting. And I mentioned in the talk that we were constantly chasing the final chapter, which in itself wasn't a great difficulty because we knew where we were sort of going. We just didn't know when it would stop. But as new things came up, the narrative changed, and I think you get a sense of that in the book, that, you know, things started, the wheels were starting to, you know, starting to fall off a bit for the Morrison government over things like the rats and the vaccination program. But it was, we ended up having to go back again and again to the same interview subjects to talk about the new things that had happened, the new developments. So we thought we were so smart. We'd had it all sorted out that this thing was going to be over in 12 months and we'd have a book out in 2021. It was a case of just going back and reinterrogating things over and over again. I couldn't tell you how many interviews we did, countless, and we would have chewed up about 80 to 90 hours of tape at least, I think, on it.
Simon, thanks for your presentation. A two-pronged question. Most federal government agencies had disaster recovery response plans and pandemic response plans, and appeared that none of them followed those plans. All of them were thrown out. I'd be interested in your views on the analysis that you did as to whether there was conscious decisions to not follow the plans that they'd all invested millions in preparing. And the second element, you decided not to pass judgment as you prepared the book. One of the most indefensible decisions taken, from my point of view, was the closure of our borders to Australian citizens not being able to return. And I'd ask whether you'd pass any judgment on that.
I have my own personal views about that, having relatives overseas at the time as well. Look, that was a pretty tough decision and quite an unpopular one. I don't know whether they would rethink that decision if they'd had their time over again. I think, this was one of the problems that I identified before with having health officials effectively making political decisions as well, because those decisions are political. You know, the health officials can give you the best advice about what they think you should do to limit the spread of a pandemic, but it's up to the government to make a decision about whether that's going to cause a riot. So I think that they did defer too much on occasion. They hid behind the medical advice on occasion, and I think they made some political mistakes. But I have my own personal views about the border closures, but I won't share those with you. But to your first question, though, best laid plans, right? They to an extent they did stick to some of those plans, and the plans weren't. The plans never went to the problems of federation, which was the borders and all those the problems that came out of that. The plans were about stockpile, about PPE, about infection control measures, and they pretty much did stick to a lot of those plans, getting ventilators in and doing all those things. The problem with the pandemic plan is that it's quite a rigid thing. It did not take account of what would happen if the states suddenly decided not to do what they said they were going to do.
Question here.
Thanks, Simon. I read the book just after it was released. Some of the premiers were obviously very recalcitrant, and I think some of the police forces were absolutely appalling in their behaviour, particularly Victoria, when they arrested a pregnant woman who's going to have an MRI, etc. But one thing I think Morrison made a major blunder was not supporting Clive Palmer's action in the High Court to sort out who had control over the borders. I think that was really should have showed a bit more gumption, I believe.
Well, initially he did support it, until he didn't. until I think Mark McGowan made it impossible for him to continue supporting it. But, I don't... as I said, I wouldn't make a judgment on that. A lot of people would agree with you, I'd say.
Simon, did you have any inkling about the secret appointments that Mr. Morrison made in terms of the additional ministries? And what's your view on that in terms of what... was his mindset governed by everything that was going on around him and the secrecy aspect due to that, do you think?
So I'll limit my answer to that to the context of the book. I won't go into what happened after the release of the book. The book deals with the first two ministries. The book deals with the first two ministries, that we reveal the health ministry and the finance ministry. And I don't think that there would have been the controversy around the broader issue had it been confined to just those two in March 2020 at the height of the crisis when things were getting pretty willing. And, of course, Greg Hunt was a party to the health one. and I'm pretty sure that went to a meeting of the NSC, so there were others that knew about it at the time as well. But no, I didn't know about the other ones. I found out about them as you did.
There's a question here.
Thank you, Simon. Supposing we have another pandemic in 20 years, are they going to do the same stuff all over again, or have they, or have, you know, some conclusions been reached and some ideas changed? What do you think?
Well, Bill Gates is already planning for the next one, isn't he? I mean, he's got the plan. Look, that's a really good question, and I certainly hope that just as there were lessons out of the Spanish flu, some of which we sort of heeded, some we didn't, I hope there are a lot of lessons out of this one, that we get the next one. I mean, you know, they're a very hard thing to manage, aren't they?
But on the politics of it all, I mean, you mentioned the Spanish flu. I think probably 15,000 died in a population of 5 million, so it was probably 75,000. But Billy Hughes won the election in late 1919, so there were all the problems you mentioned early on in your speech, but it didn't have any political consequences. Hughes did well. The Conservatives did well. Labor didn't make any ground. So what's the difference there? Is it the way it was handled? Do we know enough about what Hughes did to not have a reaction to what he did in the political sense, or is it all speculation?
Well, as you know, Hughes was absent for the entire period of the Spanish flu. He was in London. But you raise a really good point, and there was this term that was being thrown around in late 2020, COVID incumbency. And no one in government at the time believed that Labor were even a shoo-in for the next election. I mean, they thought at the end of 2020 that it was all over for the next election, that they'd managed the pandemic well and this notion of COVID incumbency that there'd been elections elsewhere. That began to unravel the longer it went on. Obviously, there was the vaccine delay. There was... I think that view was correct, a correct one to have at the time politically, but the longer it went on, you got electoral fatigue. And I think by the time the election came, people just wanted to draw a line under it and forget about the last 2.5 years. And the best way to do that, or the best expression of that, was to kick the government out.
There's a question down there. Let's wait.
Thank you. You mentioned earlier that the government's worst case modelled scenario was 150,000 deaths. Could you speak to the reason for the discrepancy between the modelled worst case scenario and the actual worst case scenario?
Yeah, I know. The worst case scenario, the 150,000, was based on and worst case is no intervention. You just let this thing run. And so that was never going to happen. I mean, the government were never not going to do anything. So, you know, throwing those numbers out were sort of pretty scary numbers. But that was, I mean, I'm not an epidemiologist, so I can't verify whether those have any accuracy or basis in true pandemic modelling. But that was the scenario that was being put to them. The more realistic one was between 30 and 40,000. And I think at the time, having seen what had happened in Italy, what was happening in New York, what was happening in China early on, the 30 to 40,000 figure was one that the government was looking at as being a realistic outcome. And that was based, I think, on numbers of ventilators, hospital beds, all those sorts of things. Not people dropping dead at home from COVID, but are treating just the sheer number of cases through the hospital system and having the hospital system overwhelmed. So, yeah, the 150,000, again, as I said, based on a no-intervention scenario by government, and that was not something that was ever going to happen.
I want to take you up on the early pandemic, 1918-19. I find it fascinating, until we had this pandemic, we never thought about it. You read history books that take you through that period and it's never mentioned. And it was a huge, I mean, it was, for Australia, it wasn't unlike the effect of the First World War. So you've gone back and you've looked at it. How much is there you can find on it easily? And why do you think it was that people just, it's a bit like childbirth, you forget the pain when it's all over. Oh, you know, is it just that people want to draw a line and go on and they don't want to look back?
I was surprised. It actually took a bit of work going to the National Archives to actually find all those telegrams exchanges. And once I found the right search engine to do it, I found them, but it wasn't easy to find. And I was, so the telegrams between Watt and Hunter, when I found those, I madly did a search through the internet and everywhere else to find where it had been used before, and I couldn't find any reference to it. And as I was pulling out more and more documents, this treasure trove of exchanges between William Watt and the premiers, I found very little. I was quite surprised. So, I mean, I don't know why that is. I think, you know, at a guess, there was a bigger event at the time being the First World War, and that's what people were writing about in terms of history. There wasn't a lot written about the Spanish flu.
Actually, about the concept of a national cabinet, I think there was a view in Australia that we had a national cabinet once, and we never did, as you know. We because Labor opposed it in opposition, and then they opposed it in government in the period between 39 and 45. But Britain, of course, had one, and there's a view that we had a national cabinet, but of course it wasn't a cabinet because there was no cabinet secrecy, there was no cabinet unanimity. Might have been better if that called it something else. Well, it used to be called the Premier's Conference, I guess, but the government, as you know, very quickly on that day when it was announced, I think in the middle of March, the government made it very clear that the federal government wanted to call the National Cabinet, but on reflection, was that a mistake?
I think there are a lot of people in the Liberal Party that think it was a mistake, but I wonder what the alternative would have been. I think the attraction for that model, especially for the Premiers and for Morrison, was that the existing process, being COAG, and wasn't ironic necessarily that they formed the National Cabinet at a COAG meeting, killing off COAG, the attraction was that it was a top-down process rather than a bottom-up process. So it was a forum where you actually had the leaders being able to make decisions without armies of bureaucrats around them, having departmental briefs having to be worked up before every meeting. This was a pure forum where all the leaders could get in there and nut it all out. They'd bring in the health experts to give their advice, they'd bring in the economic experts to give their advice. And I think I do believe that a lot of the premiers were very, very worried at the time, and they thought, well, you know, the National Cabinet could give them some cover as well. But in its infancy, it seemed to work well. But of course, the longer it went on, the more the premiers used that platform for their own political purposes.
There's a question here at the back.
Thank you very much. Let me ask you a question, and looking forward to read your books. Do you think the pandemic is a very good example, actually prove like the democracy win over the autocracy? Because today the pandemic the COVID is over almost in all under democracy country, but the like country like China, they're still kind of locked down. But I look at the very much reason why, because democracy, under democracy, you know, the government, they come up the some sort of policy initially, but they allow people, the people not happy with it, and the people will have the rights to protest and demonstrate. I mean, I almost live in Australia for 40 years, so it's the first time I saw during the pandemic, you know, there's about 25, 37 people march on the street. But that's not possible in a country like China, will be arrested. So, and, So in the end, initially maybe very chaotic, but in the end, you come up, the policy will be more moderate, government will have to change their policy. So that's how we ended, the policy we have is a lot more moderate because we encourage people to have vaccine, but also let people decide what they should, also wear, whether we should wear a mask or not. So do you think that's a very important reason we should wear? So because the pandemic can happen again, and we have to remember that is the very much reason democracy have win over the autocracy.
I'd answer that with a sort of pose a question back to you that I think a lot of people might consider that countries like Australia, democracies actually behaved like autocracies at the time. I mean, I think a lot of democratic sort of notions of democracy were set aside, closing borders, locking people in homes. I think governments around the world acted in very similar fashions. Now, in terms of protest, that is another issue altogether. I think that, but essentially, perhaps why democracies worked were they started to behave like autocracies.
Question here.
Thanks, Simon. Kind of linked to that prior question. Much of the regulatory infrastructure for the government, Commonwealth and state responses came around 2014, 2015, following, I can't recall if it was swine flu or SARS or whatever, and the Biosecurity Act, which gave Greg Hunt godlike powers. I can't recall which journalist or who, maybe that was referenced in your book. Godlike powers was one of the many gifts that keeps on giving from Barnaby Joyce, the Biosecurity Act. Do you feel there's any momentum at the states of the Commonwealth to rein back some of these godlike powers given to health bureaucrats and governments to do things like lockdowns, mask mandates, etc., and vaccine mandates for that matter?
It was the book, and Hunt used the term the divine right of kings. He described them as, you know, essentially plenary powers, which effectively put him in control of the country. And I think there's. I wouldn't be surprised if the Albanese government looks at the Biosecurity Act. I mean, in the book, from recollection, I think Hunt expresses his surprise that the laws were passed in the first place, without much protest at all. Perhaps the opposition at the time didn't really look into the fine detail of it, but one of the other aspects of that, the Biosecurity Act, though, while it does give the Health Minister extraordinary powers, which aren't able to be delegated to Cabinet, one of the issues with it is, and it goes back to the whole issue of, between states and Commonwealth and the division of powers, is under the Biosecurity Act, the only thing that the Commonwealth can't do is direct a state official to do something. So, you know, they can. I think someone in one of the departments in Canberra called it chaos at the curb, where you have this scenario where the federal government might decide, right, we're letting people back in to the country, and they land at the airport. The state government then can stop them getting out of the airport. So, while it does have these extraordinary powers, it also has some pretty serious limitations, and that's where Morrison found out he had problems, because even though it looked, it appeared that Greg Hunt was in control of the country, he was in control of the outside of the country and other aspects of it, but the state health officials were really ruling the roost.
Now we're running out of time. There's a question here, Ian. Is there a question there? Yeah. This one? That one? Okay. Okay, yep.
To what extent was there a real delay in the obtaining from vaccines from overseas, and to what extent was the government or any of the governments at fault for it?
To what extent was there a delay in the vaccine from overseas?
Who was it for? Yeah.
Well, yeah, there were delays. I think that was, it's pretty obvious, but there were, we weren't the only country. But I'm not sure I understand your question. Like, I think it's sort of self-evident that there were delays over time. But are you asking, was it the government's fault? Or?
Well, firstly, if you read in the media, there's questions of delay, but you never can quite tell. A closer look may reveal something else to be the situation. And then the next question becomes, was the federal government at fault, or were the state governments? Because I do recall the Queensland Health Minister talking down the application of one of the vaccines, which caused a panic. Now, if you looked at that in your book, and what are your conclusions?
Well, we do detail all the events that led up to all the vaccine rollouts. I mean, obviously, putting all your eggs in the AstraZeneca basket was problematic for the federal government. But it wasn't helped, as you say, by statements from particular state ministers about not taking AstraZeneca. So I think, again, the Commonwealth got blamed for everything, but there were a lot of players involved. It wasn't that simple, as in there were delays, therefore disaster. There were a lot of issues going on. There was the use of state-run clinics, GPs. You remember at the time it was even hard to get GPs to give you vaccinations. So it was a multitude of problems, but I think it obviously began when we hit trouble with the AstraZeneca vaccine.
Just a final comment. There are a lot of scoops in your book on COVID, but also the Quad, Japan, India, Australia, US, AUKUS, the submarine nuclear-powered deal, and there are others. So how do your colleagues feel about that? They didn't get the stories.
But no, you'd have to
ask. So you're probably not going to get a Walkley, are you?
I wouldn't have thought so.
No. So how are they getting on with you? How are you getting on with them?
I get on with them fine. I get on with them fine. They're all very magnanimous in their coverage of the book. I need to thank them. I got a lot of good feedback from colleagues. I mean, I shared one anecdote at the launch. Andrew Proben from the ABC, I'm sure he won't mind me sharing this again, but he sent me a text after he read the book, and he goes, "I've been dipping in and out of the book, but it's given me post-traumatic stress disorder." I mean, we're all the journalists, everyone, we lived through that. We worked round the clock for pretty much 2 years without a break. So, for a lot of people, it's a reminder of a time that they probably rather forget.
Thank you, Simon. Yeah. That was an absolutely lovely, lovely way to win. No jealousy in the Canberra press gallery, and everyone gets on with everyone else. It's a terrific way to win. So, look, many thanks for tonight. We've got copies of a great analysis and a terrific book. Got copies of Plagued here. We're right on time, so I'll just say well done, good luck, and we'll have you back again for the next book.
Thank you so much, everybody. Okay.